world's most influential voices are driving the thought leadership and change necessary to take action and reduce the threat and severity of climate change. Join me, Roger Platt, president of the U.S. Green Building Council, as I speak to environmental leaders about the impact of the built environment when it comes to solutions to climate change on my podcast series, Climate Leaders.
We have the great fortune of having Ann Kelly from Ceres, a program that is based out of Boston and involves a coalition of investors and companies that seek to promote leadership and best practices in sustainability. She directs Bicep, a coalition of 23 leading consumer-facing companies, including Nike, Starbucks, and eBay, seeking to advocate for meaningful climate and energy policy at the federal level. So, Anne, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you, Roger. Really good to talk with you.
Well, great. And, of course, your mission is wonderfully consistent with what at the U.S. Green Building Council we try to advance, which is leadership in energy and environmental design. And perhaps you could just tell us a little bit about how the leadership of these corporate players is something that you're able to leverage for accomplishing more policy progress.
Sure, Roger. And I should note that we've experienced a lot of growth. So the 23 companies you mentioned has recently grown to 38. And we have an extended, that's good news. We have an extended corporate network that, I mean, loosely includes the 1,500 companies that have essentially signed on to the fact that tackling climate change is one of the greatest economic opportunities of the 21st century. And essentially, you know, there has been tremendous progress in private leadership. As you well know, operationally, many companies have taken on the need to do increased disclosure, increase performance in the area of renewable energy, energy efficiency, reducing their carbon footprint, using water in a more responsible way, reducing waste. But all of this would be easier if we could get the rules right. If we actually had an environmental law framework, including, for example, a proper price on carbon, it would be infinitely easier for companies to meet and exceed their various sustainability goals. So around late 2008, Ceres decided that it was necessary for us, and by the way, we've been around since 1989, essentially promoting disclosure and sustainable performance and best practice, as you note. But around late 2008, we decided it was time for us to step into the public policy game and really try to make certain that the law was sending the right signals to investors and to companies and to really paving the way toward a low-carbon economy. And that's a struggle we're still in the thick of, but we've seen a lot of progress in the last few years.
Well, Anne, let me ask you a question that I suspect might be on the minds of some folks listening, which is when you engage these very high-profile corporations on issues that have important policy consequences in the United States and globally, and which also for which there are political ramifications and different people on both sides of some of these issues, how is it that you get them comfortable communicating what is, of course, in their best interest, but also in a way that does have implications for policy and law and you know, beyond just best practice?
Well, you know, we've been at this now for several years, and we have learned a lot about what it takes for companies to be comfortable advocating for their sustainability leadership goals. And companies have come a very long way in the last several years. And implied in your question is that politically sensitive? Is it uncomfortable? Is it difficult to speak to a lawmaker who may or may not agree with a company's position on climate change and energy, particularly if the lawmaker represents a different party? You know, what I've honestly found over the years is that there's a way in which the strict, clean economic business case can really transcend the politics on these topics. And when major employers like Unilever, Mars, IKEA, eBay, JLL, KB Home, I can go on and on, go in to talk to a lawmaker and they simply make the case for a low-carbon economy, for vulnerability to their supply chain, whether it's cotton, coffee, leather, various food products, that lawmakers really understand what the business decisions that companies are making. And they are really intrigued when they see major employers, particularly if those employers are on the right-leaning end of the political spectrum, you know, making commitments to, let's say, 100% renewable energy, you know, really aggressively reducing their carbon footprint, aggressively embracing energy efficiency for all the reasons that lawmakers understand, essentially to save money and to make money.
Right.
And
well, that
keep their businesses sustainable.
That seems to me to be one of the great benefits of your initiatives, is that policymakers that are more conservative tend to have, in some cases, some well-founded concerns that some policies that are intended to advance environmental protection can result in large amounts of additional governmental infrastructure and spending. And so they tend to be a little suspicious of anything that might have more regulatory or governmental investment. But when your constituency comes in and talks about how some of these policies will actually help them and will be good for business and will be consistent with their objectives, then they tend to be more trusting, don't they? That I mean, acting in your own best interest is something people in Washington trust more than something that feels philosophical or ideological.
Very well put, Roger. You hit the nail on the head, essentially. These are essentially credible messengers making a very credible economic case, backed up by their own experience. They've done the math, and they make it very effectively. So you're exactly right. And by the way, I should say that this case is made at the state and the federal level. So at the state level, it's obviously things like renewable portfolio standards, energy efficiency resource standards, and companies have been enormously effective at making the case for increased availability of renewable energy that they wish to purchase. Companies like Facebook, Google, Apple, Procter & Gamble, Walmart have said, gee, this is the goal we've set publicly. We need to purchase renewable energy. How do we make this work?
Well, let me ask you one thing that is also possibly for folks that are really knowledgeable about the national policy debates. There's often a perception that those companies that have had to invest large amounts of, we'll call them sunk costs in the old way of doing business, including utilities, are often the slowest to see economic benefit in a new paradigm. And you're talking about some very large customers of utilities. And I wonder whether you're seeing some light at the end of the tunnel on the utility side of the equation. And let me just give you my sense from a couple of conversations I had recently, where it seemed as though some large investors in utilities, and I noticed you also have investors as part of your gang, were concerned that some utilities were not, just from a pure diversification investor standpoint, were not doing enough to invest in some alternative types of energy. And so again, just purely from a economic standpoint, they were concerned the utilities weren't getting a little bit more on board with some of the policies you already emphasized about policies to advance more energy efficiency or renewables as part of the options. What's the utility nexus with some of your key players?
Well, I mean, again, you're exactly right. I mean, clearly utilities have been on the front lines of this debate. This is essentially their business as the power providers. A series many years ago put out a report on the 21st century utility. There have been several models of what the new utility needs to look like in a low carbon economy. So there's change happening. There's resistance to that change. There are many who've benefited from the status quo. But to your point, yes, many investors have weighed in with the utilities in which they are invested to say, you really need to diversify your energy portfolio. You really need to understand stranded assets and understand carbon asset risk, understand that the low carbon economy is coming and plan for that. They've really asked for strategic thinking about it, that includes the customer demand that you refer to. And in some cases, utilities are embracing that change and moving forward. And in other places, you know, there is resistance. So there's a wide range, but there's no question that the customer demand coming from those purchasers is really starting to move the needle in the right direction.
Well, I think that's huge. I think that's a huge benefit that you're helping accelerate the understanding, especially even among state and local utility commissioners and whatnot, that there are pure economic self-interest reasons why some of the big customers of the utilities and the utilities themselves and their investors in the utilities would have for more progressive policies. One of the thoughts I have is as the United States prepares to hopefully have more credibility and impact at this big global conference in Paris that's coming up in December, the question of how to highlight the commitments and the role of the private sector in complementing the public policies that the Obama administration is already advancing with the Clean Power Plan and others, help me understand how what you're doing may help the U.S.'s position be more impactful and hopefully more progressive in Paris than it's been in the past.
Sure. Well, as you know, the crown jewel of the president's overall climate action plan announced in June of 2013 is the Clean Power Plan. And that is, you know, the regulation of existing power plants. It is more than what any country has ever done to cut carbon emissions. And 365 of our businesses and investors came out in favor of the plan last August, and that was the sort of the third beat of the drum because they had come out in earlier iterations of the rule, but when it was finalized in August, that number not only stood up in support, but wrote directly to their respective governors to say, let's get moving, we've got your backs, let's get going on a state implementation plan. And since then, we know that, you know, many, many states are far along in developing those plans, and I think the private sector members in many states are being active in working with their state energy officials to try to move them forward in the direction of compliance. I think in addition, when you look, and this is, again, if we just look at, if we were to compare Copenhagen to Paris, I have many thoughts about what has changed in the interim, but many members of the Fortune 500 companies, I think we did a study, I think it's about 63% have set renewable energy goals or energy efficiency goals or both. So that's creating a certain market pull that's really also calling for the leadership of these states to comply with the Clean Power Plan, take advantage of renewable energy options, and that's right in line with what the president has called for in our own INDC, our own climate mitigation goal, which is a 28% reduction in carbon emissions by 2025 based on a 2005 baseline. So in order to do that, you know, we need robust compliance with the Clean Power Plan, as I mentioned. We need the private sector to help to close the inevitable gap that will exist even with the Clean Power Plan. So that calls for leadership. As you probably know, 81 companies stood up with the president to declare their own renewable energy, energy efficiency goals, and to call for a strong global deal in Paris. That has never happened before. And so all of these things coming together at the same time, and of course we've seen renewable energy become much more affordable in the last 6 years. All these things are coming together at kind of a crescendo moment just before Paris, which I think really gives a boost to the administration and really, you know, supports the administration's credibility going into Paris, that the United States is serious, this is real, we've made real commitments and really skillful diplomatic connections with China, with other countries. Other countries are coming forward, putting forward their goals. I mean, that's probably a longer answer than you wanted.
No, that's great, though, because I do think a lot of folks are naturally suspicious that, you know, it's possible to take a very cynical line and say, you know, the UN is like a trade association for small countries, many of whom don't have yet full economic development underway. And so they'll always be playing to their lowest common denominator. They'll always be slow to move. And you referenced Copenhagen, which was 5 years ago, just for the listeners that don't know, 5 years ago, a lot of hope and expectation around creating, again, a sort of successor agreement to the Kyoto Accords, which didn't happen. And now, what a difference 5 years makes. It sounds like you're very, very pleased with the differences in the landscape between where they were 5 years ago and where they are now. And I think that's what many listeners have to understand, because we will be seeing a lot of press around this conference in Paris. But it's possible for some folks just to roll their eyes and say, you know, these countries never, including the U.S., never really get going.
Yeah, and it's just very different this year. It's very different. The United States is taking a leadership position. We have a president who has made this his legacy, and we've seen many, many decisions that point in that direction. The private sector has stood up in an aggressive way this time, and we didn't see that 5 years ago. So there's both the U.S. leadership, there's the surround sound of many, many countries who've come forward with their INDCs like never before, publicly stating what their mitigation goals are. And then there's the role of the non-state actors, which the French are wisely giving a tremendous amount of attention to, businesses, cities, and states, and others who are aggressively stating their goals, stating their intentions. And I should say, in terms of the negotiating team, you know, never before have they gone to a COP with so many calls for action, you know, behind them. You may know that we had 10 CEOs of major food companies stand up and both pledge their own commitment to their own operational footprint, but to really call for action on the part of negotiators. You know, again, this is a we've got your back kind of statement. 6 of the U.S. major banks stood up and did the same thing during Climate Week in September to say, you know, we really got to take this seriously, and you as negotiators have an incredible opportunity. You will see more such statements between now and Paris as we get to sort of a crescendo of activity that should give the negotiators a tremendous amount of political cover to be aggressive on behalf of the United States. And we just didn't have those things in Copenhagen 5 years ago.
Well, that's super, super encouraging. And as a real leader in this area of private sector, progressive private sector engagement, I want to just mention at the end that I think we're trying to help and collaborate with you on making sure that in that, I love your phrase, surround sound of engagement from the private sector and these non-state actors, that we hear the voices of relevant parts of industry. And I think we're trying to see if we can't help you activate the big players in the real estate, engineering, architecture sector as well. And tell me a little bit about why that's important.
Well, it's essential because of the vital role that the building sector plays in terms of our carbon mitigation and increased energy efficiency. And I'm just thrilled that the building and real estate sector has come together designing its own climate declaration, perfect timing to be unveiled at your wonderful U.S. Green Bill Conference in D.C. And it's an opportunity for the built sector players to highlight and say yet again, because you have to have simple messages repeated often for them to sink in, that yes, tackling climate change is in fact one of the greatest economic opportunities of the 21st century. And specifically in the built sector realm, there are many economic proof points of that statement. So we're thrilled about the building and real estate sector climate declaration, and particularly thrilled, though, about the details. So what does that mean for an architectural firm? What does it mean for a construction company or a home builder exactly in terms of the money that can be saved, the way in which their customers are better served by healthier, more efficient, more sustainable and resilient buildings, and what is the economic opportunity that results from that for all concerned, customers, private sector customers, cities and towns. I'm really looking forward to the messages that come through when the declaration is unveiled, so that negotiators will also hear from this sector, because this is a worldwide sector that affects everyone, and the U.S.'s leadership in the green building space is renowned and can affect other developing economies so that they don't make the same kinds of development mistakes that we made, but can essentially race to the top with strong, sustainable, resilient, energy-efficient buildings and infrastructure. And I think the declaration is a celebration of that and an acknowledgement of, hey, we've got an opportunity here. You know, let's grasp it. So all good news on that front. But again, I'm really looking forward to the individual stories and, yes, surround sound that flows from that declaration and from the various signatories that are jumping on.
Well, I think we can close it up at this point. I think that your organization's real record of impact, real record of engaging top leaders is one that very much complements our efforts to have action by some of those same companies on the ground in terms of their best practices with their own building construction and related activities. So we'll look with real interest at your continuing success. We will do everything we can to try to be part of the solution and follow your lead on how to best activate the real estate sector. And I'll just ask if there's anything else, any parting words that you have that you think our listeners should hear.
Well, I think I would just say to the USGBC, keep up the good work and wish you a very successful conference coming up, I guess, next week. And it's been great talking with you, Roger.
Same here.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of Climate Leaders. Join me next time for more insights from the world's climate experts as we explore the outlook for achieving COP21's bold objectives.